On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
Shake it, don't break it.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. This is the 20th year of the show, and it's always good to have somebody I've spoken to before sitting across from me. And my guest today, the Academy Award-winning director, George Miller, I've known for almost 40 years now. I first interviewed him in 1982 for The Road Warrior, and it was one of my favorite interviews ever. I've had a chance to talk to him a couple of times since then. He is here for the newest installment of the Mad Max series, Mad Max Fury Road. First of all, George, it's so good to see you again.
1982, and the first director you interviewed. That's amazing.
Yes, it's gone pretty well for you since then. But
yeah, and you too. I mean, we're still young men, I think.
Well, you are.
Yeah.
And we talked about so much, and so much what we talked about was about the psychological import of film. And one of the things I asked you about then, I want to actually go back to, was your ability, which we've now seen pronounced over the years, is to treat cars as characters.
Look, I came to film basically out of curiosity. I used to paint and draw, and when I would look at film, I went back and wondered what the film language was. What is this new syntax that's basically developed over, it's now about 120 years old, really. And it's a new language, it's universal, and we read it before we can read books as children. Little kids can watch, not many months old, watch something on TV, and you know that they're apprehending it because they're laughing. Little cartoons and things like that. I've noticed that in my own children. So I went back to the silent era where the language was forged, and in particular the action movie, the Buster Keaton movies, Harold Lloyd movies, the two-reeler westerns and so on. And then with sound, everything kind of became much more, I guess, theatrical.
Yeah,
in
there was actually the Proscenium Arch that all the old films used to use.
Yes, because the machinery, the tools were so cumbersome, so it locked everything down. And then the sound booths, as they got smaller and smaller, as the cameras got smaller and smaller and more manageable, then there was much more agility. So that's why when I made my first film, Mad Max, it was to be an action movie, and apart from horses and there's cars. And so I always loved filming that and finding the way to tell the story one shot to the next.
Because I guess I remember we were talking about silent films because you said you liked the almost subconscious impact of silent film. And it's still something that your films almost trade in kind of a dreamscape. It's been so interesting to watch your career over the years where most of the films you've done can work without dialogue. I mean, I think about Lorenzo's Oil or Happy Feet or Babe, and they're films that for long passages don't have dialogue anyway.
Well, that's cinema. That's cinema. You know, you always pick up from the masters, and one of the great things about Hitchcock, for instance, was not only the way he made films, but the way he was able to articulate ideas about films. And he said something that was highly influential to me. He said, I try to make movies where they don't have to read the subtitles in Japan. And that really struck me. Yes, it's a universal language. And some movies depend on the spoken word enormously, and that's great, and they can be very cinematic. But in the case of the movies that I've been interested in, it's to see how much you can get across, how much feeling, story, subtext you can get across in the succession of images. Just like it's visual music, just like a composer uses music to all the causal relationship between chord progression, melody, line, tempo, and all of those things that go into music and shape the whole. I remember I was lucky enough to work with John Williams way back in the 80s on Witches of Eastwick. And, you know, they look at a scene and they kind of are looking for the count, for the click track. And he said something. He said, it's really interesting. When I look at this movie, the beat and the tempos are very, very precise. And this is purely without any sound. So there's something inherent in the performance of the actors. You're looking at, for a kind of rhythm and musicality in the way that the actors play the scene, and then in the cutting pattern. So that was the first time I realized that there is a tempo to cutting, and not just where you make the cuts, but just the overall feel.
But for me, there's almost something orchestral in the way you work, in that you often will have a dolly shot onto an actor who's moving. And so often we see a dolly, it's basically to make a point, to move into somebody who's sitting. But for you, that dolly is to move into someone as they're moving away from the camera towards the camera. And I wonder where that came from for you.
I don't know. The one thing I realized I was doing unconsciously when I first started to make films is I was really trying to create as much a sense of volume, three-dimensional volume, on the 2D screen. And so therefore it was wide-angle lenses rather than long lenses, which tend to flatten things. So wide-angle lenses, there's a depth of field. And this almost obsession to move the camera in the so-called Z or Z axis in and out of the screen, because rather than, say, zooms and so on, because it's you feel somehow you're moving in that space. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, going back to your earlier question about filming cars, if the angle is one in which they're coming at the camera or away from camera in a very, very tight eye line, as we say, then that again emphasizes three-dimensional space rather than panning across the screen. And I was doing that unconsciously, and so I was really trying to create a sense of immersion even back then. I think that's why I tended to move the camera.
It's a treatment. I'm interviewing the first person who ever asked me if I was old enough to drink when I interviewed him. That's George Miller. His new film is... as director is Mad Max.
Did I ask you that?
We had a drink after. He said, you old enough to drink? So I guess I'm wanting this too, because again, for me, there's almost a tradition that you kind of grew up in of the Australian car film, of the Car Late Paris or Stone, or all these films that basically treat Australia as the West.
Yes.
And that was a very kind of different idea than a lot of the Australian films that people maybe knew about. As somebody who went to drive-ins and what we call B pictures back in the 20th century, I got to see a lot of those movies. But there was a sense of immediacy in those films that you wanted to bring to your movies, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. Australia didn't make many movies, but for a whole host of reasons, in the 70s, there emerged almost unbidden a whole group of people making films. And with a little bit of government support, there was, you know, filmmakers like Peter Weir and Bruce Beresford and a whole bunch of them. Everyone started making short films, and there were what we call the filmmakers cooperative, where people would help each other. We all learned from each other's film. If someone wanted a sound recordist, you know, we'd grab some equipment and teach ourselves to record sound, and we go and help someone on a film. And at the time, there were a lot of period films, and there was a sense when you look at everybody's work together that somehow we were catching up in the 70s on Australian history. But then there were others like me who moved into genre. But for me, doing Mad Max, it was like a sense of, you know, we're not slumming doing these so-called B-grade drive-in movies. I mean, again, for that reason, those reasons I mentioned earlier, I thought it was where cinema language was forged. But it also came out of the life that I'd experienced. You know, I grew up in remote rural Australia with big, endless roads, and the car was the way that young people somehow expressed themselves. They'd drive down. I'm sure it's an American experience as well, but they'd drive down the main street at night, up and down. It wasn't a long main street. And you know, the sort of hot rod culture and stuff, I remember that as a kid. And then, you know, going to movies. I just love those Roger Corman movies. And where all the great, so many of the great American filmmakers started, you know.
But I mean,
so,
this maybe one of the first questions I even ask you, that the cars had personalities. You cast the cars as if you were casting people, didn't you?
Well, in particular in that movie, that Max's car, but I can't take credit for that because Byron Kennedy, my late partner, he wanted to take whatever budget we had and put it into one great muscle car. And it's still there in the Mad Max movies. We called it the Interceptor.
Yes. But in Road Warrior as well, I mean, those cars had personalities too. I mean, each car, each conveyance was there to sort of give us a sense of who and what was driving it.
Definitely. I mean, definitely. When we got to Road Warrior, which is the second film, we had a bigger budget. So the art director and the team working on the vehicles were able to sort of basically express characters. And even when we got to Mad Max Fury Road, you know, that became very, very serious and deliberate issue because we saw the vehicles as an extension of wardrobe, just as props and weapons were. So you had the Immortan Joe, who's the tyrant, who has the most over-the-top vehicle, which is somehow two Cadillacs, one on top of the other with massive wheels and whatever. And it was a mobile throne, and it was part of the pageantry of his power. And whatever he was wearing in his wardrobe was then reflected on the interior of the vehicle and so on. So that applied to virtually every vehicle.
Yeah, because they've got to make an impact or else it's just a procession of cars. And it's one of these things that so often when they're car chase movies, I mean, you think about the way Friedkin cast that car in The French Connection or the way Spielberg cast the car in Duel.
Yes.
I mean, or again, going back to Peter Weir in A Car They Pass, that car. I mean,
yes.
These cars are all you see them. And you think, whoa, I hope I see this thing again. And that Interceptor, if Byron certainly pushed you toward that decision, but you made the decision to use that car, and it's followed through in everything you've done. All these cars in these movies have been there as kind of homes in a way. I mean, they're these places where these characters, to some extent, live, aren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, I never thought about that before, but the in a way, Fury Road is quite an intimate film. It's a group of people in a confined space. They are homes. They are little habitats. And I think they actually, within the resources of the wasteland, they decorate them in a way that they would homes. I mean, it's all very functional. They're weapons and everything in this movie is found objects repurposed. So a steering wheel is not only a steering wheel; it's decorated in as we see in the film. They almost become religious artifacts.
They're everything is totemic in the movie, isn't it?
Yes, very much. Even the vehicles. I mean, even the War Boys, Nux, played by Nicholas Holt. He has scarified like a tattoo on his body. A map of the engine block, of an engine block, because they believe that these vehicles that have survived some apocalyptic event are really unique. And as you say, totemic. Humans, and particularly they who are half-life war boys, already suffering from some sort of toxic disease, they are fragile, but these machines are forever. For me, that's why they spray their mouth in chrome, because they want to sort of say, well, we want that permanence of those vehicles.
Yeah, we'll take a break. My guest, who is keeping Detroit alive, is George Miller. His newest film as director is Mad Max Fury Road. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. One of my favorite people to talk to is sitting across from me, the Academy Award-winning director and an Oscar nominee again, George Miller, for his news. He's worked with animals. He's worked, he's adapted books. He's done true life stories. He's created his own mythology that led, that inspired the Saw series.
I'm told that.
But I guess one of the things I want to talk to you about, too, the thing that's run through all of your movies is the idea of sacrifice for the future. I mean, some character basically trying to build their life around keeping their children protected. That's the thing that's run through every single film that you've made. And that's really interesting because it started clearly before you were a parent. But that the idea of keeping, of children being these sacred objects, really, almost religious objects, in fact, because they represent the future, is really fascinating to me. And I wonder where that comes from.
There is a sense that we collectively, as human beings, are on some sort of human adventure, the meaning of which we don't really fully understand, but we struggle always to understand that. And it goes without saying that whatever we do, if we can, in the way we address the world, we need to regard the future. Otherwise, we're kind of doomed, and we're seeing that now. I mean, things move very, very rapidly, as we all know, and there's almost an accelerated pace, driven, I guess, by technological advances, and in every way, whether it's the medical technology that keeps so many of us alive, just simple things like hygiene, water, you know, clean water and antibiotics, things that so many of us would not be around had it not been for those. And that's been only, you know, a lot of that's been since World War II.
Yes, and all these things you're talking about, basically less than 100 years.
Yeah. So, and then the other technologies, modern communications and modern travel, and it's extraordinary to think that we can have devices in our hands that can tell us exactly where we are
and what time it is,
and what time it is, and that time it is, and get instant information and send it out, and so on. All of those things, we're heading into some future, and it's almost bewildering. And there's two responses, I think. One is to try to clamp down and be fearful of change, or try in a helter-skelter way to understand it as best as possible but to manage it.
But those poles exist in the movies, people who are fearful of change, who want to maintain the status quo, and people who are bound for only to protect their children to look towards the future. It's in Happy Feet. It's in Witches of Eastwick. It's in Lorenzo's Oil. It's in the Mad Max film. It's part of all these movies.
Well, the other way for me, the only way I can explain that, the other way for me is the basic classic hero myth, the Joseph Campbell hero myth. So, and the essence of that is the hero is the agent of change, that basically through relinquishing of self-interest, they basically somehow adjust the world and in a sense bestow a boon on their community. It's pretty classic, and I didn't. The only reason I got into it, and so many people got into it, particularly in the movie industry, is that I couldn't understand why the first Mad Max, a film which I thought was barely releasable, it was so hard to make. It was such a low budget.
You thought barely releasable?
Oh, yeah. It was. We made that film on a very, very small budget. I mean, if you look at the credits, there are only about barely 30 people on the credits. And Byron Kennedy and I did everything. We delivered the screenplays on the back of my motorbike. Whenever we do a car crash in the back streets, we'd sweep up the broken glass. We would do everything like that. But I thought if you really planned a film meticulously, it was just a question of going out and executing it. I was very naive, but that's what I thought you do. What happens is you get in and make a movie, and there's always something conspiring against your best made plans, and you have to be able to make you know, micro mid-course corrections and adapt to the circumstances as best as possible. I didn't understand that. And we ran out of money for post-production, so I spent the best part of a year editing it myself and confronted every day with all the things that I wish I had done or should have done or problems I couldn't solve. And that was a really, really powerful experience because I was confronted with this sense of failure. When the film did go out from Australia around the world and was a big success in so many different cultures, I wasn't silly enough to think that that was all my doing. So I asked, why is it working? And why do the Japanese see it as a samurai? Max is a kind of samurai. Why did the French critics talk about it as being a Western on wheels and so on and so on? So that's when I started to read up about, you know, saw the Joseph Campbell's Hero of the Thousand Faces and all his great study on comparative religion and folklore and so on. What is in common in all of storytelling, which is something that happens reflexly in all cultures across all space and time. There's always narrative. It's the way that we make the world coherent to ourselves, and we share the world through stories. And that got into Mad Max 2, which was Road Warrior, and it was much more conscious. And Max was indeed a reluctant hero in that sense. He was someone who thought he could only survive by himself, really didn't put much store in others. But you're right, in Mad Max 2, there's that feral child. And basically, Max then stepping away, as I guess the classic Western heroes did, and give over the future. But, you know, go to a movie like Babe. The moment I read the story, it was written by a farmer, Dick King Smith, who happened to write great children's stories, but he was a pig farmer himself. And in this one story, he basically, even I guess without knowing it, had that classic structure of the hero myth. Babe is a character, and it's stated explicitly at the beginning of the movie. Babe changed his valley forever. It was classic hero myth. You see it about as the future, and there's no question it's about the future. Same with Fury Road. But I see it as hero myth, which essentially does the same thing.
The reason I talked to you about Bruno Bettelheim when we met was that fairy tale thing, that idea of protecting children, the idea of the most primal fears being visited in fairy tales. That's the reason I mentioned that to you, because those two movies, at that point you made only two, connected to me so deeply to Bettelheim.
I think he had said something that I've observed through life over and over again. Now, with kids who want the same story over and over again, they are in their own way processing something. If it's, I don't know, Hansel and Gretel, which is an incredibly dark story. I mean, a weak father with a cold stepmother who wants to get rid of the children, basically abandonment, and then the children then get seduced by a gingerbread house and utterly, you know, totally indulge themselves, and then they have to become, to survive, they have to kill the witch and so on and so on. They're pretty dark stuff. So kids, we want that story over and over again, processing something, and suddenly we've seen they just stopped. They move on to the next story because something has happened. And you see that with movies. Parents tell me, you know, that they watch Babe or Happy Feet, they watch them over and over until the parents can't. The kids insist that the parent often stays and watches with them. And so many people have said, you know, I've watched Happy Feet like 70 times. And then suddenly it turns off, it's done its job, whatever that job is, and they're moving on to the next thing. So I think we still do that in a way with stories, even into, you know, all the way through our lives, and particularly with movies. We are definitely processing something. It's almost an unconscious thing. I'm sure we could sit and analyze it and so on, but quite often it's through stories. A little bit like dreams, really. I think movies are an extension of that. I mean, so many people have said, you know, it's public dreaming, really. We sit in the dark theatre with strangers and dream in public.
It's the treatment. We're talking about mythology, dreams, and movies with our old friend George Miller, whose newest film as director is the Oscar-nominated Mad Max Fury Road. I guess as you're talking about this, I think I've read any number of psychiatrists who said that movies have changed the way people dreamed. That there's been a notice that movies, that dreams have more of a narrative structure. I mean, if you read about Freud's essays on dreams and how sort of impressionistic they are versus dreams after the advent of movies as a public forum, and movies have changed the way people dream. They've actually added a narrative to them.
Really?
So now we've arrived at a time where I think, and your movies to me feel like they're very much a part of this, where there's a conversation between film language and dream language.
Gosh, these are great conversations, Elvis. Every time I come and talk to you, even though it's 40 years apart, I get all this great stuff. Then I go and read up about it, and I say,
I have a whole lot of time to think about this. Yeah. But I guess I was wondering, as we were talking about this, what were the first films you showed your kids?
Basically, kids' film. I mean, as my kids start to grow up, there was VHS and then DVDs and so on. So, you know, I took them to my favorite film as a kid, and still one of my favorite films, Pinocchio. I thought there was a lot of stuff.
Did it scare them?
I warned them enough about it. You know, my daughter was around about the age of 2.5, 3, grappling with the nature of death, because one particular point, she didn't want to go to my mother's birthday party because she saw birthday parties as people getting older and nearer to death. And I didn't realize, until I asked her why, I didn't realize that was going on. And she was able to articulate it well enough. So when we see a Bambi or something like that, and you sit and talk about it and so on, it's a great way of processing. We did it also through children's books that deal with it. And then, you know, you get through all the classics and they love them. Some they reject for whatever reason. And then pretty soon they're watching pretty sophisticated movies. I found them watching movies which had a lot of talking in them, and they weren't just sort of action movies and necessarily popular movies, and really got a lot out of them. Stories should have a label, you know, hazardous material. Not that we should in any way censor or manipulate our stories, but just be aware that they can have a big effect. And you can never predict what that effect would be. The interesting thing about it, you make a movie. I've never written a novel or anything, but, you know, I've made movies, and you cannot predict what the response can be. It might be total indifference. And you think, oh, this is really important stuff here. And people just see the movie and say, yeah, that was okay, and completely forget it. And other things which you don't expect, people still talking. You bump into people and say, you know, I got so much of that out of that movie. And they want to talk about it and so on. And it takes a while when you make a movie to even understand what you've wrought. It takes quite a while for people. You read the reviews and people talk about it, and maybe up to 5 or 10 years later that, you know, when you look at it and you see somehow that there's been something there that has some degree of meaning to people. And all you can do as a storyteller is put your best effort forward and try to put a lot of subtext into the story. Even something like Fury Road, which could be just a chase film, you know, I like to say we try to put a lot of iceberg under the tip. So I don't know. It's a mystery. I've been doing it for a long time now, and it's still a very mysterious process to me.
And we've been talking about it for a long time. We're out of time. I'm so sorry. You have to come back. Please come back and do the show again, George. It'd be great to have you here.
Yes, after all this time. Thanks so much, Elvis.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah. My guest, who makes movies that people are still talking about over 30 years later, is George Miller, whose newest film as director is Mad Max Fury Road. Our recording engineer here at NPR West is Patrick Murray. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Blake Button, who's associate producer. I'm one of the living. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.